On the show today, we have artist Bianca Beetson, a proud Indigenous artist and researcher living and working in Brisbane. We discuss her impressive work unpacking the human experience, decolonisation on an individual level, and sacred spirituality. She has an amazing story about her work with the landscape of Murdering Creek. Please do not miss this special episode.
Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.
I've known Bianca for a very long time, since we were both young lasses. It's such a pleasure to be able to meet with Bianca. We tried this podcast before, but we had rubbish Wi-Fi, so we decided to do it in person so we could actually record it. So Bianca, welcome. And could I ask you to start off and just tell us who's your mob, where you're from?
Okay, thank you, Danielle. And I think we met in 1993.
Jesus.
That's giving our ages away too.
It's a mystery again.
As Danielle said, I'm Dr. Bianca Beetson. I'm a proud Cubby Cubby woman, also with Wiradjuri, Googie Yalanji, and Pitta Pitta connections. So, yeah, lots of different mobs, but very proud. But I've always been predominantly lived in Queensland, and particularly, had a lot of connections to the Sunshine Coast. And always claim Cubby Cubby first, because that was my grandmother's line, and we claim matrilineal.
So Bianca, when I met you, you were studying at university art. I don't actually can't recall the name of your degree. Was it a bachelor of?
It was the Bachelor of Visual Arts.
There you go. You've had quite a celebrated career as a Aboriginal artist, and you're now working in the space where you're teaching. So tell us where you're working now.
Well, I went from, I still consider myself as a practicing artist, even though my husband and I were having a bit of a discussion about this yesterday. But I did make work on Wednesday. Running the Bachelor of Contemporary Australian Indigenous Art degree, which is the only one of its type in Australia. But in February this year, I actually moved to be the Director of Indigenous Research at Griffith University. So it's kind of interesting to see an artist moving into that sort of research, Indigenous knowledge space.
And what did you find you were passionate about researching as an artist?
I think as an artist, we always are researching everything we do, and I don't think people actually understand the level of knowledge translation we do as artists, in that research process. But there were sort of lots of different areas. One of my doctorate was all around Aboriginal identity through self-portraiture and looking at that, the relationship, how we decolonize ourselves as individuals through a creative process, and looking at deeply what my identity was, being both Aboriginal and my mum's got Scottish heritage. So I've always struggled with that sort of thing of being in my skin and not being dark enough, or not being to call myself Indigenous or Aboriginal, and not necessarily being white enough to fit in with white kids, but always had this really strong, deep spiritual connection to my Aboriginal culture and heritage. So that was sort of a part. I think the doctorate process was really mostly for me to try and figure out what the hell is going on. Who am I? Even though I know after many years, I was feeling quite comfortable in my skin. But so I sort of started looking at what makes us human, and thinking about the way Aboriginal people were treated as being non-human. And so I kind of started really unpacking that humanity and what is it and what makes us the same as everyone else, what makes us different. And talking about that human experience, that experience as a mother, that experience as a woman, as an artist, as a teacher, as a healer, as a traditional owner, as an ancestor, a whole range of things. I kept looking at all those different things that make up who we are and the different hats we wear. And as women, we have to jump from one hat to another to another. You walk in the door from work, then next minute you're mum, you're with a wife, you're the cook, the cleaner, the nurse, you're everything. And it was also looking at the demands that are placed on us as humans, and particularly as women. And then also looking at where place belongs and how we connect country and how we tell our stories and our ancestors' stories through self-portraiture. So my portraiture was very layered, and a big part of it was trying to capture the metaphysical as well, because to me that's something that is part of the reason why people buy Aboriginal art, and that is they buy Aboriginal art because they want the spirituality. They want that connection to that higher sort of spiritual element that exists within our culture and us as human beings. I kind of wanted to try and explore using photography and lens-based practice a way of trying to capture that metaphysical. I've always tried to do it in my work, and that was, I mean, my original doctorate was going to be looking at black magic. I was originally looking at two elements around death and burial practices and black magic, but I kind of went, how do you publish that stuff and put it out? And you know, the whole doctorate process has been, you know, making it public. And I was like, I think I might be opening some things that a can of worms that I shouldn't open. So I kind of went, I'll just leave that where it is and sort of brought elements of that into my practice. But you know, the other area that I'm really interested in too is, you know, looking at colonial frontier violence and the impact on country and place and location as well. Because, I mean, you can't escape from that. I mean, even in my own heritage and you know, family heritage, there was elements of impacts on the, you know, Aboriginal side, but also on the non-Aboriginal side, you know, there was possibly perpetrators through, you know, early colonial settlers. So,
You know, Bianca, your work, particularly some of your recent work, really influenced me and the work I do in my practice at General Practice Training Queensland. So I'd been thinking a bit about a landscape legacy, so what the landscape is telling us, because I really wanted GPs to be mindful when they plonk themselves in an office inside a, you know, closed-in walls, you've got a computer screen in front of you and you've got a patient that comes in. Whose land are you sitting on? But beyond that, what is the landscape telling you? What has been shed on that ground? Has there been tears that are spread on that ground? Has there, you know, been bloodshed? You know, has there been laughter and joy or little children's feet running around? You know, like for me, the landscape holds an energetic imprint that can be heard by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and reflected by them, I think, in their themselves. And so, you know, there's that notion when the land is sick, then Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will be sick. You know, it's that cultural, it's because that's our great mother. And if our mother is sick, then we are sick. If our mother is burning, then, you know, that causes us, it's such a deep grief in our hearts. And so I'd been thinking about this and trying to think about how I could bring that into the work I do and how I could start getting doctors to shift their focus from just staring at a computer screen to be sort of mindful of what the landscape is telling them. And then I came across, and I hope you don't mind us having a chat about this, is the Noosa River. Bianca and I are Facebook friends, and I saw something, some post, and it was talking about some of her artwork that she did that was about confronting, I suppose, the truth of what it was happening up around Noosa in the colonial war times. And what I saw was a photo of Bianca had particular words that were put into a creek up there. And I think that that caused quite an uproar what I witnessed in the comments of this gentleman was the cracking of the white fragility or the white privilege, is that he felt that his family, the first sort of people there, like he felt he had some lineage because his family were trawlers or whatever they were. And so that was his lineage, and that the fact that there was something else going on there, just watching him implode on social media was really interesting. And the other thing I found that was really interesting there and beautiful was the swell of support that you received. This guy just couldn't get it. So there's a murdering creek, I think, is one of the stories. I'm going to hand over to you so you can tell the story better than me, but I just wanted to preface about what I saw.
Yeah. I mean, when you were talking about the landscape and the mark that is left behind from colonial frontiers, I call it indelible stain, you know, and that's why I called the work that I created was called Indelible Stain, because you can wash the blood away, but the blood never goes away. It's always there.
And just our CSI shows.
Yes.
Gets into the cracks of the floorboards.
Yes, and you get that torch out.
Yeah, that special blue light layer one.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, so this Murder in Creek work, I'd actually curated an exhibition 2 years ago on the Mile Creek Massacre down sort of in Inverell, sort of outside of Inverell, and it was the first Aboriginal massacre where Aboriginal people were, non-Aboriginal people were found guilty of murder of Aboriginal people. So it became quite a landmark kind of place, and it was a landmark case. But, you know, what made was all these other massacres be silenced. So there became this real silencing of history through that process. And, you know, for many years there's been so much contention around Murder in Creek on my site. So, you know, when the elders up there, up at Sunshine Coast, have been working on Mile Creek, they were like, we want you to come and do something to tell our story, to tell the story of Murder in Creek. And, you know, you drive past, and I've always said, you know, I've been involved in previous symposiums and things around that space, and the local council were putting pressure on me to do a memorial. And, you know, being a public artist as well, I was going, no. And they were like, but why? And so I did this at this presentation. I showed all these really massive, big, ugly monuments, these big white kind of monuments and memorials. And to me, I believe that you'd ruin, and to also put those monuments in, you often destroy the site. I mean, you know, I was over in Canada about 4 years ago, and I went to Smashed in Buffalo Head, and they had built an actual cultural centre on the site of the World Heritage Site where the things happened. So that, to me, was really quite disturbing, and I didn't want to be a perpetrator. And it was really about white guilt and making the non-Indigenous people feel better because they've put a white man's memorial up on that spot site. So currently there was this, you know, old stake with a laminated piece of paper stuck to the site that said this is what happened. One of the TOs had put that up there. And I knew the site hadn't been cleansed, hadn't been cared for in the way that Mile Creek had been cared for. So I wasn't ready, and I was quite reluctant to do anything about the site for quite a few years. And I needed to give space between the Mile Creek and the Murder in Creek shows because, for me, it's quite emotionally draining when you're dealing with this deep, heavy research. And
you can stir up, and I'm going to interrupt you there because I'm curious. It's almost like the spirits start talking to you as well when you're researching their story. And if you don't give it a big break in between, then it almost like becomes too much for you as a person who's receiving that information.
But they also, sometimes you don't notice them either if you don't have a clear head to be there. And then one day the director of the Noosa Regional Gallery, Kent, said, let's meet. And I'd heard whispers and rumours that he was interested in, he, you know, had a real interest in Mile Creek, not Mile Creek, Murder in Creek, sorry, himself. And I went, it's time. And I kind of had worked on this project for Listening to Country with Dr. Leah Barclay, who's a eco-acoustic ecology, I think it is. It's where she actually records the sound of trees and earth and water and a whole range of stuff. And it's, you know, really based around that idea of Jadiri and that deep Aboriginal way of listening to place and country. But she's got technology, and it's really cool technology, you know, to do it. And so Leah and I decided we wanted to collaborate on the spot. So we started, we went out one weekend, and we just spent the whole day recording. I'd been working, you know, I'd been doing the research and kind of planning what I wanted to do on the site. And every time I went out on the site, what I wanted to do changed. But that was partly because the site was telling me things. You know, I originally went out there and I had a plan. This is where I wanted to record, and this is where we're going to do things. And because no one was exactly quite sure, even where there was a sort of, in the text, there was an idea of where the massacre occurred, but it wasn't clear. But through our process and working on the site, we found the space, we found the place, the ancestors led me to it. So it was this kind of, you know, we went out there and we worked, we spent the day, and I was doing tree rubbings, and I'd written this genocide poem based on a thesis that had been written on Murder in Creek. It was the only actual major piece of written research work that had been done. And so the intention was I would read genocide poem through the sounds of the country itself. And that was the genocide poem was also what was actually then put into that creek at Lake Wyber. So Murdering Creek is on one, is basically in Lake Wyber. Lake Wyber runs into this side creek, Perigian, and the other side is Noosa. So you've got, and one side's on Sunshine Coast Council, the other side's on Noosa Council. So it's kind of, you know, quite interesting. But the whole project was about mirroring and looking and reflections, et cetera, et cetera. So when we were working on the site on the first day, Leah had gone down the night before and she tried to do night recordings. And she arrived and she, you know, put the paper bark over the top of the recordings and left it there. And it was really dark. And spooky. I'd never go there after dark by myself. And she'd gone and it was really windy and scary that night. So, you know, I was just like, what the hell were you doing? And, you know, got really cross at her. And she, when I arrived, she said, look, none of the recordings worked. And, you know, her batteries had been fully charged, everything. The recorder had actually been switched off. So
I just got tingles then.
So I, you know, my first thing to her was we're not to record at night. And then it became more and more obvious every day we worked on the site. But so the first day when I arrived, I just stood there and I, you know, took my clapsticks out and I kind of acknowledged the ancestors and, you know, asked if it was okay for me to come in, told them that I was there for good intention and that I wanted them to tell me their story through me, you know, what happened here, what happened to this country. And then this tree starts swirling, like to wave me through, and then another one starts swirling and I started just walking along following these trees. And I had no idea where Leah was and took me to Leah. And Leah was in this part that I'd never been to before because I was never game to walk that far in. And she was there recording at that point, and there was a couple of other incidents that told me this is what happened, this is where it was. And the water on the surface of the water that day was angry and there was this tension. And it was like this. It didn't ripple like normal water. It pulsated like it was electrically charged. And she's recording and she puts the recording in my ears and she said, listen to this. And you could hear loud gunshots in the water. And she said, I've never ever heard this before. She's recorded all around the Maroochy River and everything like that. And then there was this sort of loud, eerie, you know, like horror movie sort of synthesizer. There was that going through. And she said, the only time she ever gets that normally is power lines. And there was no power lines nearby. And she checked, you know, there was nothing in the creek itself. And she said, there's some electromagnetic force in this creek. And just as it was getting to dark, I decided it was time for me to record the genocide poem. And I'd found this scar tree. And I'd spent a lot of time working with the scar tree and rubbing it and talking to it and, you know, and we'd done recordings of it. And we decided it was, and the scar tree was right in the spot where we believed that the massacre could happen. You know, I could see things that told me that as well. And I put my hand on there to record the poem through the scar tree. And next minute, my phone was almost, you know, flat and her technology was sort of not fantastic. All of a sudden, I couldn't remember what I was saying or doing. There had been all this wind going through and everything just went dead and still and calm, completely still. I couldn't remember what I was saying. I couldn't record the poem. I couldn't speak. My phone went from 0 to 98% charged and her technology just stopped. And then I kind of went, and then I could smell the ancestors. And I just turned to Leo and said, they're here. And I had goosebumps and, you know.
I've got them now.
You know, and it took me a little bit of while to get myself together. I was a bit kind of rattled. And I tried to read the poem and I just kept messing it up and I kept messing it up and I kept messing it up. And then about 5 minutes went by and I kept trying to push through and push through. And next minute the water starts pulsating again and the wind starts flowing and my phone went back down to like 2% and her technology started working and I remembered the poem. And, you know, it was after I'd sort of spoken to them, I said, look, I acknowledged them that, you know, that they were here and, you know, again, I got my clapsticks out just so, because I could also tell because I got an automatic ricochet, so I want to use the clapsticks. and you'd hear nothing, they're not here. But when I did that and I got a straight response, I knew they were here. So, it was quite amazing. And then after that, you know, we quickly did what we did and I said, Leah, let's get out of here. I don't want to be here after dark. The next night, all around the site starts burning. That was the massive big Parisian fires. And actually, as I was leaving, I said to Leah, this place needs a really good burn off. It hasn't been burnt for years. And I said, you know, and then the next day the fire started and she messaged me, did you open the gates of hell? And I was really worried, you know. I was thinking, did I do the wrong thing? Should have I been on that site? Should I have been working? And I, you know, started panicking. And the fires kept going right up to the day before we had to install the work. Like, and in fact, there was still smoldering when so we had to install on, that happened, I think, on the Saturday. No, it was the Friday. Fire started early Saturday morning. And then on the Thursday we had to install. So we went up, we wanted to see the site before we installed. Like Lee says, I can't work on it when the site's burning. And I was feeling the same and I was really emotional. I was just an absolute wreck over what was happening and constantly trying to figure out, is the site damaged? All around the site was burnt and the site was saved. And we went on the way to install and did some new recording and the whole energy of the place had changed. But the water was black. Like black, and that would have been the charcoal and ash. And we were expecting this doomsday thing of dead animals and everything to float through the water. And everybody, all the birds were chirping because the first time we went there, they all had this awful alarm sounds. They weren't happy. Everything was angry and cross. And the gunshot sounds had disappeared in the water. But there was still that electromagnetic sort of sound going through the water. But the water was rippling and it wasn't pulsating. And so we kind of, you know, that day it was kind of, there was a few little more things that sort of I picked up on, but when it really had a cleanse. But then the next time we decided, you know, during the project, we were going to do live surveillance at the site itself. And again, everything would stuff up. We couldn't do it. And the ancestors were telling me, no, we don't want you recording after dark at night, you know, blah, 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 and a whole range of issues were going on. And we wanted to do some live feeds. We did a few when we were physically there, live feeds from the sound online so people could hear what it sounded like then and there on the spot. But the very last day, again, it seemed to be quite a normal day, but I kept finding all these artifacts and objects. Like right where we were standing, I found these quartz stone axes. And stone knives that had never turned up before. You know, there was all these little things that had happened and you know, finding more scar trees. I had these Japanese artists come out and work and rub this one massive tree that to me was the witness tree. Just as we were leaving, Leah was right out recording in the mouth of where the Lake Wyber goes into Murdering Creek and she screams out to me, quick, come here. And she looked like she was surrounded in a rim of blood. I thought she'd been injured. And she said, I got out of the water. I thought I'd had a leech or I'd cut myself because she said I could see myself surrounded these rings of water. And as I walked in, all these rings of what looked like blood were circling me. You know, and then everywhere, you'd walk and these rings of blood would surround us. And, you know, we were digging, trying to figure out if it was tannin in the water. There was no explanation. It was almost like, it looked like, and it wasn't sitting on the surface of the water, so it wasn't oil or anything like that. It was just under the wood. Like, it was like a shark attack had been in there, you know, or blood. So it really freaked me out, you know. And then all of a sudden we started getting surrounded by bubbles. And I haven't been back to the site yet, but that was our last experience. And we were like, the ancestors, I did ask the ancestors to tell us what's happened. And, you know, and now this is the blood of the people that were put in the water. And I've got photographs and everything of it, and I did a bit of built that into the documentation, but it was just, you know, incredible. So when you talk about memory of place, I mean, if you are open and listen to it, it's there. You know, every time we went, we got a piece of the puzzle and the clue, and it was just, and the day we went there, the water itself in the creek was blood red. You know, it started black at one end and then it went down to blood red right up the top. It was, you know, every time we went, the water changed, the temperature changed, the atmosphere changed. It was just bizarre. In fact, I was talking to Leah yesterday about it. We're kind of going, we're keen to do some more work out there, and we're going to do some more, maybe some 3D, 4D recording stuff, and really do it, you know, do some more documentation on that space.
It's amazing because from what I understand, that the history of that was whitewashed. So it was almost flipped around, and correct me if I'm wrong. So what I understand is Murdering Creek, the story that has sort of been perpetuated in the white sort of civilization, was that the Aboriginal people crept up on the white people who were sitting on the bank and killed them. Whereas I believe it was the inverse.
Yeah, I mean, what I've been told was somebody disguised themselves as a swaggy, and the Aboriginal camp people were camping on the other side, and they came across in a canoe and to, you know, attack this swaggy, which was not right, and they were shot as they were in the water. So they were actually murdered in the water. And, you know, I've played some of the original footage to one of the elders, and she's like, I can't, you know, and that sound with the gunshot, and there was this muffled voices in it, and she said, that's them drowning. And, you know, it just, and that would also explain some of the bubbles, the blood. So
oh, yeah. Shot,
and the bubbles, it was like, you know, and it just,
wow.
You know, the story was coming out as we were doing it. It was just phenomenal. But even like, you know, the whole community, it's such a contested space. Like people who live on Murdering Creek Road always complain because their house prices are brought down by the street sign's name, you know, by the name of the street. And, you know, we see that as being the most important memorial because it makes people ask questions. Well, what happened here, you know?
I did see old mate on the Facebook post was trying to get, he said, well, why don't we just change the name? And they're like, everyone's like, stop whitewashing the history.
Yeah, and that's what they've been trying to do for years in that area, particularly because destroys the house prices, and it's like, oh, for shit's sake, sorry.
Yeah, you can swear, that's fine.
You know, and yeah, so I think that's all, the only memorial we need is that street sign, because it just reminds people constantly of what happened, connected to a website. The other thing I suggested when we talk about custodianship is you know, rather than have a memorial, let's plant a tree as a community. If we're talking about reconciliation, let's go out there and we plant a tree. Everybody in that local community or anybody who's interested is custodians of that tree. So they have a duty to make sure that that tree survived, and that memory and the reason why that tree was planted survives. So it's their duty to tell their neighbours about that tree and why that tree was planted, and the story and the history behind that tree, which is connected to the site. And then, that, you know, and it's passed from generation to generation, you know, and that whole proper custodial sort of way of talking about, because it's shared history. So, you know, non-Indigenous people have to be custodians of the story as well. And so that was kind of my solution around the whole, oh, but we need to have a memorial and a way to say sorry and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's Reconciliation Weekend. I'm going blah, blah, blah about saying sorry.
It's all right, mate. What a privilege to be able to hear that story, and to be able to hear how the ancestors spoke to you and led you to the site. Wow. It's amazing. I was really interested in your story when you were sort of talking about the trees that were swirling to sort of lead you to a place. And I think that if we learn how to listen to country, all of us, it can tell us a tale or it can lead us in a particular way. Like, you know, I think there's nothing weird. I've got a big tree on my property that talks to me. You know, am I mad? No, I'm going to say on paper, knock on wood. I'm going to knock on wood and annoy my sound person. But I think that we have the capacity to really listen to country. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, I've been working on a major research project with Leah and a couple of other people, Vicky Saunders, who's an amazing Goongri woman who's very much about research through creative, you know, lenses and poetic inquiry, and then a lady called Dr. Sarah Woodland, who's at University of Melbourne. And we were working, this is even sort of in between that space, between Mile Creek, Murdering Creek, we were doing a project called Listening to Country. And we are actually currently about to sort of look at more iterations. We've just put in a huge ARC grant application. Fingers crossed.
We'll Fingers crossed, everyone.
To do the next iteration, and we're looking at doing listening labs across the country with communities. But it started sort of, it was an accidental project that we've realized is much bigger than what it started. And we're looking at healing and using sound of country as a healing tool. And so we were working with it was just January last year, we were working in the Brisbane Women's Detention Centre to trial this project, Listening to Country, with the women, incarcerated women. And we were looking at the mothers, the sisters, the aunts, the daughters who can't connect to country because they're incarcerated. And, of course, there's layers and layers and layers of trauma and reasons, et cetera, why they're in the situation they're in. And so I myself and Vicky and Sarah and Leah, we worked with them to create a soundscape that was theirs, and that was a unique soundscape, so that when they were feeling really homesick, feeling disconnected and feeling often agitated and needed a change of the sound. Some of the women were talking about there's nothing worse than when you wake up in the morning, you can hear the sound of a woman crying because she's missing her children or her husband or whatever, and how they could change the agency of sound, and control the agency of sound within the prison institution, because I believe it's actually part of the torture technique. The amount of sounds and the beeping and the prison landscape is very similar to the hospital landscape, and it's just abrasive. You can't relax. You're always on edge. There's always something going on, and there's always some trauma going on. And so we created the soundscape with the women working on their country. I called it their belonging place, because not everybody knows where their country was and that place that they feel connected, that place where they feel safe. And I got them to reflect on those park places. What is it? Is it a waterfall? Is it, sitting by the beach? What? Where's your belonging place? That place that gives you energy and heals your soul. And so we did this sort of whole soundscape, and it's an hour long. Soundscape that actually talks about these women's belonging place. And it was interesting, because we had to teach them to listen. That was one really important thing, because, we don't take enough time actually listening and observing. Everything's hustle and bustle. And so the women listened for maybe 30 seconds without running, to the door and looking what else was going on. And then by the end of it, they were able to lie for 45 minutes, eyes closed, on a yoga mat, listening to the sounds of country. So it's amazing how you can train people to listen, and they started feeling the benefits. We got them to kind of draw and do a whole range of other things to bring this energy in and get their reactions. But we worked with the elders as well, which was really important. We had two elders, and we wanted this to be a tool that the elders can use when they go in to meet with the women, that can build on on what they do and kind of help support them and actually get them focused. And so as I talked to more people about it, we realized what other impacts it has as a de-escalation tool in hospitals when people are really anxious. But I'm also really keen, and we're hoping with the ARC stuff and some of the future other conversations we're having, to look at what role it plays with, for instance, Indigenous people with diabetes, and how can they stop them so that they stay and have their dialysis rather than go back, miss country, because, you've got a lot of your desert mob don't want to do that because they're missing country, or looking at palliative care and helping people pass over with the sounds of country and stopping that, bringing down that anxiety and stress that's happening in that space. And we've been talking to the midwives up in Townsville as well around that as a birthing and listening to the sounds of country as the child's being born, but also, helping relieve stress and anxiety in pregnant women. So there's lots and lots and lots of applications beyond just the prison system and thinking around psychiatric hospitals, etc. And the other thing we've been using is these transducers. So the idea is that you put a transducer on a seat, or we were looking at possibly inserting it in a wall or a desk or a table, and you can lean on it and your body becomes the speaker, so you actually feel the sound through your body. So I remember the first time I tried that in the transducer, I was really, really stressed. I'd had a really terrible day. I rushed to this meeting and Leah sat me in this chair, and she just played whale sounds, and I felt like I'd had two Valium, within 5 minutes. So it really, brings your heart rate down and, really connects you. So that's probably one of the most important parts, is bringing that transducer technology in so you actually feel it in your body. And it was interesting for me as a visual artist to be working on a sound project, because I kept thinking, well, where do the visuals come from? When you're listening, you're seeing it in your head. The elders we were working with were going, oh, this reminds me of when I was in Cherbourg and I was washing my clothes on the rocks, etc., and it was bringing out all these stories. And one of the aunties had a acquired brain injury. So it was really interesting to see how it triggered stories for her and how it, you know, we're bringing stuff. So we're trying to record her stuff as it was coming out as well, because, you know, it's unlocking these gates that were kind of not necessarily there. So, yeah, that's sort of, you know, there's so much potential. And with the listening labs we're looking at, we want, you know, because one of the things we've struggled is, well, how do you make it specific for Pitjantjatjara mob, or, you know, for the Goongwari mob or whatever? So that's why we want to do listening labs and train communities to actually control the sound and record the sounds themselves. And then, you know, we've got websites and stuff that we can actually, you can just plug in and you can have it password protected for communities, etc. I mean, the prison one is password protected because we want the women to be able to own that.
Wow. That's amazing. Particularly, I mean, I'm passionate about, you know, what I call crossroads medicine, birth and death and all of that, and be able to pass with that, you know, being sung home almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or being welcomed into the earth. That's beautiful. That's so, and I think that that would be such an amazing tool for our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients. And I do, you see it, like even my poor old father, when he used to have to be in hospital for a long time, it's frustrating because it's like you're being caged. He felt like he was caged in there. So if he had something like that to be able to, like, listen to the waves or listen to the old aunties cooking or, you know, something like that, or the crackling fire, I think would bring a lot of peace to people.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And I think it's a universal thing, that connection to country, because one of the team, you know, and being she was non-Indigenous, but she was talking about how her grandfather, his most precious possession was this handful of dirt he had from Wales or wherever it was from. And she said, you know, when he died and when he was sick in hospital, he wanted that dirt brought to him, you know. And I think, you know, that energy, that earth and that connection to earth is just phenomenal, you know, absolutely phenomenal. You just can't, yeah.
You can't replace it. Yeah. Well, Bianca, I'm going to leave it there, because I think that that's such a powerful point to end on, is that understanding your sense of belonging, understanding the need to listen deeply. What a fantastic conversation we've had today. I've really, really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for coming, Bianca. We're going to have a link to your fantastic research that you've done, your doctorate, and any other artworks or maybe stuff around Murdering Creek for people to have a look at. So that'll be on our show notes today. So thank you so much for coming again, Bianca. I love you, love your work.
Thanks for listening to Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Please subscribe to the podcast and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.